Everybody's going to ask you questions.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. The game of life is hard to play. I'm gonna lose it anyway. The losing card I'll someday lay. So this is all I have to say. Suicide is painless.
Suicide.
It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please. The sword of time will pierce our skin. It doesn't hurt when it begins, but as it works its way on in, the pain grows stronger, watch it grin. Suicide is painless, it brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. A brave man once requested me answer questions that are key. Is it to be or not to be? And I replied, oh, why ask me? Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please. And you can do the same thing if you please.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Eric Danger Nonice.
I'm Jeff the Collector Abadi.
And I usually start the show off with a little bit more excitement in my voice and a little bit more. But this is such an honor for me. For a couple reasons. I am here with someone that changed the whole chemistry of my family. My father struggled with drug and alcohol addiction his entire life, and the only thing that ever made him happy was MASH and Max Klinger. It's the only time I ever saw my father smile, the only time I ever saw him be happy. And at a very young age, my father had a thing about taking me to go see the most random movies on the planet I would have nothing idea about. And we were in Montclair, New Jersey, and we went to go see Annie Hall. It premiered at the Bellevue Theater. And I remember sitting down, and it was raining outside, and my father was sitting to my left, and I was to my right, and there was about three or four seats next to me on the right. And a gentleman comes in and sits next to me in a bright yellow raincoat. I couldn't have been more than 8 or 9 years old when Annie Hall came out. And I remember my father just staring. Just no words, no expression, just staring. And I looked over, and I'm sitting next to Alan Alda during Annie Hall. It is absolutely, I want to dedicate this episode to my dad and for my mom to make me appreciate character acting. Jamie Farr is here.
Thank you, Eric.
I got chills.
Yeah, Alan is very charismatic, as was his father. I'm sure you remember Robert Alda.
Yes, and his brother.
Yes, and the brother.
Yep.
And his whole family. For me, being on that show was the most fortunate thing that ever happened to me in my life, and I had been in the business for quite some time because my first movie was Blackboard Jungle.
I'm going to talk to you about Santini in a minute.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, I've had ups and downs in this business, as we all have.
Have we ever? Yes.
And that was one of my down periods when I finally was able to get on MASH. And,
yes.
And who knew? I came in for one day and stayed for 11 years, so I was quite a parlay.
Well, my first question, and again, I have a separate section just for MASH questions.
Okay.
But I have a really cool section that I spent some time working on this morning. Because, again, I stayed acting for about 3.5 years, and I spent 3 years on with SiriusXM. But I appreciate really good character acting. How, at such a young age, did you find mental illness in your character with Santini?
I love this business. I used to go to movies, just as your dad took you to the movies. I used to go maybe 3 or 4 times a week.
Yes.
And we always had neighborhood theaters. You know, you get in for 12 cents to see a double feature, Three Stooges, a travelogue, a cartoon, a cereal or that, and popcorn was a nickel in a brown paper bag. Well, I used to hang out there all the time. And I, too, I love the character actors.
I love them.
Alan Jenkins, Frank McHugh, I can go. I'm getting older now, so it's a little harder for me to remember a lot of the names. But I George McCready. You know, I could name any of the ones that were on the screen and knew their names, and
right.
I was happy to see them.
Isn't that great?
And so when I got a call to come in at MGM to the screen test, I was at the Pasadena Playhouse as a student there, and I was on the main stage helping out in one of the shows, and a talent scout saw me. And he said, you're the right age. Would you like to come to MGM, which was, of course, the creme de la creme of studios, as we all knew growing up, and screen test? So I said, oh, yeah. So I went to the studio. I was so nervous and frightened to walk through those gates.
I bet.
The Thalberg, you know, building and all these other places and the soundstage and... I forgot the name of the stage, the number of the stage, but I didn't screen test with Glenn Ford. I screen tested with James Drury.
Wow.
Who later was the Virginian.
Right.
And he played Dadier.
He's still with us.
Yes. Jimmy's still with us. Yeah.
Yes, he is.
And so I didn't know that much about it, but they gave me the glasses, and I just tried to find whatever it is that it was in the dialogue. You know, he's listening to what the other people said about Santini, because I didn't have that much of a background on him.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, how do you... Because we have all these other techniques now that have been developed over the past 30 years or 35 years. How do you find it? Like, where is it?
I just thought... I played him as a nice person who was kind and gentle and had simplistic. Very, very simplistic.
Okay.
This was good, and this is evil.
Right.
Where he got the notion of which is which, I do not know, but he knew the difference.
Right.
And so that's how I played him. I always played him gentle and kind and nice. And I think Mr. Brooks, who was the director and screenplay writer from the Evan Hunter book, liked that very much. And so did Pandro S. Berman, who was the head of at MGM at that time in productions,
okay.
Even though Louis B. Mayer, you know, was still at the studio. So that's what I did, and I got lucky. And that was my first movie, and to work with Richard Brooks and Vic Morrow and Sidney Poitier and Paul Mazursky and Richard Kiley and Louis Calhern and Anne Francis. I mean, what a cast.
Jeez. And Jamie Farr.
Oh, but, we liked Anne Francis.
Yeah, Annie was a great gal. Lovely gal.
You know, MASH was filmed down here at the Malibu State Park.
Correct.
Sadly...
Down a couple of times.
It burned down a couple of times, and, you know, the last bits burned down the recent fire. You live very, very, obviously very, very close to the set, so you must have just, like, finished work and, you know, took you a little
time. Well, we didn't
do
that many shootings, filming at the ranch.
Right.
We did it mostly. We had an indoor-outdoor set
right.
at 20th
yep.
Century Fox, and then we had an outdoor-outdoor set at the ranch, which is in Malibu Canyon, Las Virgenes. So when we did, we'd probably take a couple of shows,
right.
and then we'd do several different shows while we were there at the ranch. But yeah, it was easy for me to commute. The tough one, of course, is going to Fox at Motor and Pico. There, that was a tough one coming from where we all live here in the Ventura County area.
Now, I wanted to ask you an interesting question. You're originally from Toledo,
yes,
Ohio. Now, obviously, your your character is also from Toledo, Ohio. Was that something that was planned or something that just made it easier?
What happened was Gene Reynolds, who was the producer of the show, who also was a terrific child actor, and then later became a director of a lot of TV shows. I was doing an F Troop. Hi Averback was the producer of F Troop, which starred Forrest Tucker and the late Ken Berry.
Yeah, if you look right here.
Oh, yeah.
If you look right there. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Ken is an old friend of mine.
I love him.
And Larry's still with us.
Larry Storch, yes, is still with us. But I played a stand-up comic Indian.
And
they
gave me
all of the old Milton Berle jokes and the Henny Youngman, you know, and said, take my wife, please. Take my squaw, please, and that. And Gene was directing, and he liked me. He used to write down any actor that he liked in a little black book. And when some kind of part would come up that he was casting or something, he would call upon that person. So what happened was Gene is also from Cleveland. He originally came from Cleveland, Ohio.
Right.
And Cleveland and Toledo and, you know.
Chillicothe.
All the Buckeyes.
Yeah.
So and then Larry Gelbart, who created the character of Klinger, which is based on the there again I'm starting to slip.
That's okay.
The comedian
Milton Berle.
No, for crying out loud, Lenny Bruce.
Lenny Bruce. I love Lenny Bruce. Oh,
yeah,
genius.
Lenny Bruce was in the Coast Guard, and they always have dress of the day, and they would have, you know, you come in with your fatigues or your class A's. So he literally took them as dress of the day and showed up wearing a dress.
Right.
And
that's great.
But they threw him in the brig. But Larry Gelbart came up with the idea and said, why don't we use that? That's a funny bit, gimmick. But I didn't get thrown in the brig. I get to stay for 11 years on the show as opposed to going to jail. But Larry Gelbart was a teenager going to Fairfax High School here. And Larry's father, Harry Gelbart, was the barber in Beverly Hills to all the comedians.
Gelbart.
Danny Thomas, Milton Berle, Jack Benny, George Burns, Sid Caesar, everybody. And so he got very friendly with Danny Thomas. And he said, Danny, my son, Larry, he's a high school student at Fairfax High. He writes jokes. So Danny said, all right, let me see some of the material. So Larry brought him the material, and Danny liked it, and he bought it. And he used his material. He was one of the first people to buy any kind of humor material from Larry Gelbart. Well, Larry Gelbart never forgot that. And he knew that Danny was Lebanese, and Danny was from Toledo, Ohio.
And so, one of your mentors.
Yes. And so when I came on the show, he decided, let's make Jamie from Toledo and make him Lebanese. And then he got the name Klinger from Larry's childhood friend. Larry grew up in Chicago before he came out here to California. And so he named him Klinger after his childhood friend.
That's very fun. That's very fun.
Now, you know, you started off as a corporal, I think maybe episode 4 or something, and then you became a sergeant.
Yeah, it took a long time to become a sergeant. Yeah.
So the question is, did you ask the producers for a pay rise after that?
No. Let me tell you about 20th Century Fox at that time. You know, there were only 3 networks. And if my agent went to ask for a raise on the show, they would say, listen, there's a script in the safe right now that says Max Klinger steps on a landmine.
Wow.
Well, my agent would exit quickly, and it was
have
all
a nice
over.
Day, and thank you for everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. No, they were very, very frugal. They didn't pay a lot of money at all.
Wow.
And if you asked for a raise, first of all, we paid for coffee on the set. We paid a quarter for a cup of coffee.
Did you really?
Yes. Wow. And
every season,
every day.
Wow!
I think a lot of people probably gave up coffee.
Wow. No, they didn't. But I'm saying to you, then the craft services started to bring out some Ritz crackers with some peanut butter, and we would go down there. They didn't charge us for that. And Mark Evans, who was then the head of the production areas of the studios, the stages there, wrote a note and said, this must cease and desist. There's too much money being spent on Ritz crackers and peanut butter.
Wow.
So Cy Salkowitz, who was then the head of the TV department there, all 7 stars of MASH got out a $100 bill, and we walked over to his office in unison, put down a $100 bill, each one of us, $700. He said, what is this? What is this for? And we told him the story. He said, I can't believe they're charging you for coffee. They're charging you for peanut butter. And He says, what do you want? What do you want? Crunchy, smooth? The next day, we had cases of peanut butter that went from the floor to the ceiling. No charge for coffee after that.
Isn't that great? That's an awesome story. You got to work with Hunts Hall.
Worked with Hunts.
Oh, my God. I am a...
Chicago Teddy Bears. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am
Mickey Shaughnessy.
Oh, I am a huge Dead Ends kid. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the Marx Brothers. Dead End kid.
Oh, sure.
You know... What your comedic style and Hunts Hall must have been like a box of dynamite going off.
Well, it did go off because we were off in 13 weeks. it didn't last. It was Dean Jones was a star, and it was a funny show.
I bet
it was a comedy Untouchables.
I bet.
And Mickey Shaughnessy and Hunts and I were the three hoods on that, and the chief hood, who was the Frank Nitti kind of character, was Art Matrano. And John Banner was in it, and Mike Mazurki. Remember Mike Mazurki?
Sure.
He was wonderful. He was in Murder, My Sweet. He was just terrific.
I'm old school. I am definitely
Richard
old school.
Powell, yeah.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work for some reason. Plus, we were on Friday nights on CBS, and I think NBC at that time
was killing everybody.
Yeah, was ruling the thing. So we didn't...
But personal chemistry with you and Hunts Hall.
Oh, yeah. Hunts... Well, you know, again, Hunts is really old school. I mean,
really super duper old school.
You know, Warner Brothers, and then eventually the Monogram movies that they did, the Bowery Boys, the East Side Kids, the Dead End Kids, and all that.
Yep.
That stuff. So, yeah, it was
Angel and Dirty Faces, Cagney, all of it. I watched it all. Absolutely.
I got to see James Cagney when I was doing Blackboard Jungle at MGM.
Wow.
He was doing Love Me or Leave Me with Doris Day. And I was walking around the lot, and I go, oh, my goodness, there's Doris Day and James Cagney.
Could you imagine?
I wanted to walk up and say something, but I didn't want to invade his privacy.
Yeah, I know.
But that was it was quite a treat to, well, at that time, you know, you'd be on that lot. You had Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, Robert Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor came on the set. And she was undoubtedly the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. She was married to Michael Wilding at that time. And she came to visit Richard Brooks. He had directed her in a movie the last time I saw Paris.
Okay.
With Van Johnson. And, she was everybody would pop on the set, you know, to see Mr. Brooks and to see... I still call him Mr. Brooks.
Yep.
I know he's passed away of that, but... He was my first director in of films and that, and he was a very brilliant, brilliant man. That being at that studio was such a treat. And as he later wrote, we had a pretty good class. John Erman,
okay,
who later became a director in some features as well as TV. He was in that cast.
It's a hard transition to go from actor to director. I'm doing it now as a producer, and I'm just overwhelming. It's just a lot of work.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, it is. You forget all of the areas that you have to cover.
Yeah.
And you also have to be a good diplomat and somebody also that knows the people that you're working with.
300 problems.
Sometimes you have to be nasty, and then sometimes you got to be really nice to somebody.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I was like, I just want to go and hit my marks and go home, you know?
You know, I wanted to ask, Jamie, you know, Alan Alda, I mean, just what a great actor. And
oh, he's terrific. And a nice man, you know, that's...
Is he a nice man?
Oh, he's a very, very
thank God,
nice man.
Now, he reminds me a little bit, you know, I was a class clown at school. For all those people listening to Australia, they know I was a class clown. Obviously, he was a class clown on the show. What was he like, you know, between takes? Was he just like the guy's just got so much energy and personality.
What we used to do, because it's a one-camera show, of course.
Was it a one-camera show?
Yeah, one-camera show. Unless, you know, there were scenes that we did at the ranch, we'd have a couple cameras then to cover
any
action things or explosions or things like that. But no, it was one camera show, no audience. And we'd come in on Monday to read the script, and then Gene would go page by page with everybody. Does anybody have any qualms about something here and there?
Sure.
And you could discuss it. And you could say, I don't want to say this line, or you could say, I love this line. Can I add another line? You do whatever you want. But Gene would always say, I am the arbitrator. Once it comes down to I'm the person that has to make the decision, that stays, and you can't change it after that unless you come to me personally to change it. So every page was locked in on that reading day. And then what we would do the next day, that same day, we'd get it up, and with the camera operator, the director of photography, and our director, then we'd start putting the scenes together, wherever it was, as much as we could do, and then start shooting the next day. Well, when they would do the setups, we had a little tent that we went into with our chairs, and we would run the lines.
Wow.
Back and forth, just like a play.
Right.
It got to the point we knew the timing of everything. We knew the exact words to say and maybe add a few things, business or whatever it was. It was very exciting to work with those people because they were really interested in their characters and interested in what we were saying and doing. And that's hard to find sometimes with a complete group.
Because
everybody's running the phone, you know, they want their publicity person or they want whatever it is. But we were actors. You know, we all came from the stage.
There was never missed a beat.
Yes.
Never missed a beat.
But you know what? Why the writing was good is because the actors were good also.
Oh, it's just
because sometimes you can write something for somebody,
sure.
But the performer is not capable, you know, of delivering it the way they want it to.
Yep.
The world was their oyster with us. You could give us anything and we could do it, and which we did. But Alan was absolutely wonderful. He very supportive. And he and Mike Farrell would play chess sometimes in between. And then we were practical jokes. I mean, we did all kinds of silly things, painting people's dressing rooms when they weren't looking, orange and purple, and doing things like that. And, of course, you know, we had replacements on there. McLean Stevenson
left,
Harry Morgan came in. And they were all equally as good, you know, different, but equally as good.
So let's go back and talk about McLean Stevenson and some of his brilliant writing. I'm going to take a quick thing I want you to hear. And it's the first time I ever saw you on the show. So maybe this will bring back a little bit of memories. And again, I want to pay an ode to McLean Stevenson, who I loved.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yes.
So just take a listen.
Klinger, the rifle makes me nervous. Actually, the purse does too. Just sit down, take a load off your heels. What's your problem, which I may have tattooed on my forehead?
Doc, this is a mail call today, sir.
What is it?
It's a letter from my mother. Dear son,
you obviously haven't sent her a recent picture.
I hate to bother you in the middle of a war, but I have some terrible news. Your father is very sick. If he knew I was writing to you, he'd be very angry. Fortunately for us, he's in a coma.
Clear.
Sir, please. We know your colonel has a good heart, and surely he'll let you come home for your father's funeral. Or his 65th birthday, whichever comes first. I will close this letter now, son of my heart, because my tears are making the paper soggy and hard to write on. Your loving, aggravated, broken-hearted mother.
Uh-huh. Here you go. The father dying, right?
Yes, sir.
Father dying last year. Mother dying last year. Mother and father dying. Mother, father, and older sister dying. Mother dying and older sister pregnant. Older sister dying and mother pregnant. Older sister dying and mother pregnant. Younger sister pregnant and older sister dying. Here's an oldie but a goodie. Half of the family dying, other half pregnant. Klinger, aren't you ashamed of yourself?
Yes, sir. I don't deserve to be in the army.
Yeah, well, thank you. That McLean made that work, though, just the way he delivered that. But the things that he tried to do to get out still makes us laugh.
It's amazing.
With Harry Morgan, we used to break up when Harry took over, where I came in and I said, I lost my two brothers, Maurice and Hakeem, in an explosion in the Toledo harmonica factory.
Yes.
I mean, harmonica factory.
So... To close out talking about McLean Stevenson, I had read, especially right after it had, I saw it. I don't know when I saw it. If it was in, I definitely had to be in rerun, maybe. But no one got the script or the part where
right.
where we were told yeah. that Henry Blake's plane went down.
Right.
We talk. You and I have talked a little bit about Loretta Swit. Her reaction should have won her a daytime Emmy Award or an Emmy Award. It was, I mean, boom.
What happened? I don't know if you know the backstory of why McLean left.
Well, he got Hello, Larry. I remember he got...
No, that wasn't the reason why he left.
I don't know then.
The reason why he left is Mac would, on occasion, be the guest host of The Tonight Show for
okay.
Johnny Carson.
Okay.
Johnny Carson wanted to take a leave.
I didn't know that.
Bring in McLean.
I did not know
and
that.
And so... you know, there were three networks at that time.
Yes.
And MASH was a very popular show.
Yep.
And it was on CBS, and The Tonight Show was on NBC. Mm. So what they thought they would try to do is convince Mac that he would be the heir apparent to Johnny Carson
wow.
to take over The Tonight Show to sabotage MASH. So, wow, that sounded good because that's really where Mac thrived in. He loved that.
Oh, yeah.
The kind of ad-libbing and
quick
interviewing.
Wit.
And, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And so with that thought, his contract was up
right.
with the show. I think it was the third season
right.
When Mac left. And, of course, he told Gene and Larry Gelbart, Gene Reynolds and Larry Gelbart, and they were obviously unhappy because he
I
was a character that was so important to the show, and the show was doing so well.
Right.
And to take him out of it.
Plus, he was a canon character from the movie, you know?
Well, he wasn't in the movie.
But the character was.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they decided, okay, war is hell.
Right.
Let's when he's going to leave, let's make it something poignant.
Right.
And so what they decided to do without the cast knowing about it and anybody else knowing about it, when we said goodbye to Colonel Blake.
With the wingtip shoes on.
With the wingtip shoes on
yep.
and the kiss to hot lips
yep.
and everything.
Yep.
And then taking off in the helicopter, Loretta and I went home, Gary, everybody, we went home. And they said, oh, we want you to come back. The next day we have an added scene.
A pickup or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what it could possibly be.
Because you've never done pickups before, had you?
Well, we said goodbye to him.
Right.
And that was
what
the end of the
decide?
Script.
Right.
Yeah, that was what the last page was.
Sure.
So when we came in, they took us aside, didn't tell the crew,
wow.
didn't tell the extras, didn't tell our mini-MASH, the ones that had several little lines here and there.
Yep.
And told us what they intended to do because they said, you know, we're going to have, this is what happens in war. You lose people that you love.
Yeah.
And we want the audience to feel that.
Yeah, I did.
So Gary was very upset about it. He voted not to want to do that.
Right.
I didn't say anything. Everybody had an opinion in that, but that was the way it was going to go.
Wow.
And so what you saw on the screen...
Yeah, was real.
Was real.
Yeah.
All the
you could,
reactions...
I believe, but you couldn't fake that.
Yeah, the reactions were, oh, I can't believe this.
Right.
They couldn't believe that Colonel Blake was shot down and no survivors, you know, and couldn't believe that they did that to a major character,
It's
you know?
Funny, right?
Yeah.
And I not to cut you off, just to follow that up, I was a big fan of Ugly John and Spearchucker and all those guys.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I explained to him that Ugly John was the Australian anesthesiologist.
Correct.
You know, they just, there was no, I mean, unless I missed an episode somewhere, did they just segue them out?
You know, they had so many running characters. It was a half-hour show.
Right, I know.
And they had Spearchucker, as you said. They had Odessa Cleveland, who was...
great actress.
Ginger, Nurse Ginger,
yes.
I think.
Yep.
And they had some guy that was supposed to be from Oklahoma. And then they had Ho-John or something. One of the...
Right.
The
well, they segued him out by going to the United States to go into school.
Yeah,
but Ugly John and Spearchucker just vanished.
Yeah, Ugly John. And but there was also... Lieutenant Dishy, I think,
yes.
was on that as
yes.
well. They just had too many characters, and they were too many characters that crossed over one another.
Right.
You know, and half hour with the commercials in it. I mean, how can
22
you get
minutes
that?
Of
how
of,
can you give everybody that much time?
Right.
So they decided, okay, who's different? You know, And that's why I stayed. Obviously, I was certainly different, not only on that show, but any show to be on. And so that's, you know, Gary was Radar, and then Loretta, and then Major Burns. He was the villain. You know,
What a great actor, Larry Linville.
And,
huh?
And of course, Wayne and Alan, and they finally found their nucleus. They found what it was to build their stories around.
You had a lot of young actors come on the show
that
went on to become quite well-known actors.
Yes,
Ron Howard.
You can name Ronnie.
Ron Howard. Didn't John Travolta
It wasn't John Travolta.
But it was everybody got their beginnings.
John Ritter.
That's who it was. I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh my goodness, there was a whole bunch of them. I can't remember all of them myself. And a lot of the major actors, Harry Morgan and Ralph Bellamy. We met Ralph Bellamy, wonderful actor, great actor. Yeah. Wanted to do the show because he loved Harry and he loved the show, and they didn't pay that kind of money in those days. I think the top of the show for a guest on a half-hour show like MASH was like $2,500.
Wow.
Now, Harry came in as a general.
Yeah, the general, the flip at dawn.
The crazy general.
Yeah, exactly.
They must have obviously liked him to come
back. They loved
him,
yes, they did. Now, and he was wonderful also because it was awesome, much different than McClane, but a very added feature to it, the old Army guy, and he was more in control as an officer than...
Cavalry guy.
Yeah, old Cavalry guy.
Yeah.
That picture on his desk, was his actual wife.
That was Eileen.
That was his actual wife.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah. Eileen. She passed away... I forgot. I'm not sure whether it was during the series or not, but yeah, that was his actual.
He lived to his mid-90s.
In his 90s. Yeah,
he had a full life.
We dearly loved Harry. He was the patriarch of.
That's amazing.
I loved him on Dragon.
You know, I'm the patriarch now.
Now you are.
The remaining five. Yeah.
Is that all that's left? Is five?
Yeah.
We lost everybody.
Yeah.
There's.
I'm the patriarch. Then there's Alan.
Right.
Then there's Loretta.
Yep.
And then there's Mike, and then there's Gary. So that's our age range now.
Yeah.
Did the chemistry of the beats of the show change when the cast changed?
It changed differently, but with great quality. It still had a quality to it. That's what I'm saying. Whatever replacements that we had, they were all different, but they brought something very special to the show and made the show equally as good.
No, it did. And that is lightning in a bottle, because when I watch a show, and I'll give you an example, I watch Special Victims Unit, Law and Order, and I gravitate towards the show because I liked Ice-T. I liked his raw, you know, untrained acting. And then you put him with Mariska Hargitay, and then all of a sudden you stay for the writing. Like, you come for one reason, but if Ice-T would have left, I mean, I don't know if I would have stayed with the show. My point being, huge Trapper John. I for some reason, I just enjoyed Trapper John, and I enjoyed Wayne Rogers very much. And when he left and they segued, you know, Mike Farrell in, I just didn't know if I was going to stay. And I did. Do the producers ever worry about that?
No, but Mike Farrell did.
Did he really?
He was very concerned. He thought, oh, I'm coming in the show, and I'm going to deep six the show if the people don't like me. And that, yeah, he was really very concerned. Actually, Alan and I took Mike out before he started the show. I forgot where we went. We went to some little bistro in Beverly Hills.
Okay.
And we all had a little too much wine. We didn't drive home. We had a car.
No, I believe, right.
But we wanted to create a camaraderie with him, so he knew that he was very welcome there and that he wasn't going to be a...
It was a good fit.
Yeah.
No, well, yeah, it was a great fit.
I was just going to say that the shoe fit, yes.
I saw the reunion, and Wayne Rogers came to the reunion show. Is there any animosity between...
No, not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, it is probably the most wonderful group of people I've ever worked with.
Wow.
As I say, I go way back, and I know you're a big movie fan.
I'm a huge movie fan.
The people that I work with, Boris Karloff, Errol Flynn.
Huge Boris Karloff
Jane
fan.
Jane Mansfield, George Raft.
Yep.
Bobby Rydell, Fabian.
Sure.
I worked with Roger Moore, and not only in the Cannonball movies. Yeah. I know you got a picture
of
that.
Well, we got to talk.
But I did a movie called Diane.
Right.
I had a small part in that, and... Yeah. He was with Lana Turner and that. I mean, I've worked with so many great, great, wonderful actors and actresses.
Sure.
And it was an honor for me, you know, to be a part of it and to say that.
Unbelievable.
That I did work with all of them.
Wow.
Yeah, Red Skelton was my mentor. I did the Red Skelton show.
Yeah, no, for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I did it live with him. Sherwood Schwartz was the head writer who later did
Gilligan's. He loves Sherwood Schwartz.
Gilligan's Island.
He loves Gilligan's Island.
And Brady also Brady. But yes, of course. Yeah, Sherwood was the head. Actually, it was Sherwood that brought me to the Red Skelton Show. I had done a pilot with for CBS that didn't sell called The Mighty O. And it was about a Navy thing. And it was Craig Stevens was the lead in it. Lola Albright, who we later did Peter Gunn with. Alan Hale Jr., who did Gilligan's Island. Richard Jekyll. And myself and a guy by the name of Jack Prince, who was on Andy Griffith's show of that. And it was a very funny pilot, but it didn't sell. So Sherwood saw the pilot, and he said, you know, we're looking for some new characters for Red. Why don't we take this character that Jack Prince had? He was the cook on board the ship. And take this young kid that they have on it with the big nose. And the character was called Snorkel.
Okay.
And so he said, why don't we take the kid if Red accepts him?
Sure.
You know, we got a new thing and an army thing. A military thing.
Sure.
We could do something with it. So they called me, and I said, Red Skelton. I used to listen to him on radio.
Isn't that funny?
I loved Red Skelton. He's one of my absolute favorite. I used to see all those MGM movies that he did, Whistling in the Dark, Whistling in Brooklyn, et cetera, Whistling in Dixie. And then we went to his home. He had the old Tom May home up in Bel Air, of the May Company.
All right.
Beautiful home. And we went through these gates up this long driveway, much like coming to your house.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went there, and they knocked on the door or rang the doorbell, and he opened the door, and there's a 6'3", 6'4", red hair, and he's got a Japanese kimono on and a Yukon bird on his arm. He takes a look at me and looks at my nose. He says, when your mother was pregnant, was she frightened by an anteater?
Nice.
Then he says, do they throw your nose out in back of a ship as a rudder, use it as a rudder? He did about 10 nose jokes, you know.
Sure.
We just hit it off great, and I wound up live television. This is
unbelievable.
Live. Can you believe that?
I've done live radio. It's nerve-wracking.
Scared me. I'm 19, 20 years old.
Oh, man.
And television wasn't very old then.
Well, the only person that had cue cards was Red.
Yeah.
So when he'd ad-lib, it's a half-hour show. You know, the people, the stage manager would come to you and say, Jamie, we're running over. Can you jump to page 32?
Wow.
I go, what's on page 32? You know,
right.
And I got to give them the lead-in so they can get the cue cards turned over so that he can go. Oh, my goodness. I tell you, I almost had a heart attack.
I bet. Every night.
Yeah. And what, the first show we did was they got me in drag. It was
really
what happens is that we find and Alan Hale was on the show too. Alan was one of the first guests on the show, Alan Hale Jr. So we find a baby. Somebody leaves this Korean baby with us, and Red falls in love with the baby, and he wants to adopt it. We hide the baby on the ship from the captain and various other people on the ship, and we're going to dock in San Francisco. And he finds out the only way you can adopt a baby is if you're married. So he decides he's going to dress me up as his wife, and we're going to go in. Well, I'm telling you, that the screams that we got, Olin Soule, I don't know if you remember Olin Soule, wonderful actor. He was the person who was interviewing us for the...
immigration.
To adopt, to see if we're good
parents. Right, okay.
Parents adopt the baby.
Great. Oh, my gosh.
Well, Red couldn't keep a straight face.
The whole time.
He laughed. I had a kinescope of it. I wish I could find it. I'd love to show it to you sometime. It was one of the funniest things that happened. But that's what really helped me make my career starting.
And
then I just went back and, you know, continued to be with Red every so many shows. And then I got drafted into the real army, so I had to leave.
Right, and you spent some time in Korea.
I did, Korea and Japan, yeah.
Is it true that you wore your original dog tags in the show?
Uh-huh, I still have them, yeah.
You still have them?
Yeah.
Hasn't any of the museums asked you for them, or
no,
like Smithsonian or anything?
No, I don't think I wanted to give them away. I gave, a lot of our stuff is in the Smithsonian.
Yes,
beautiful.
DC. Yes, that's what I was saying.
I have some of the dresses I wore. You know, I wore Betty Grable's outfits.
You
Alice
had the best
Faye,
wardrobe.
Dame Mae Whitty. And my favorite is...
You were probably the only one with a wardrobe budget.
Ginger Rogers. Let me tell you the story. We did... it's a Gold LeMay one.
Yep.
And I pretended I was Ginger Rogers, and Nurse Kelly pretended she was Fred Astaire.
Love.
And we did this cheek to cheek. We're dancing cheek to cheek.
Right.
And I got this outfit on, and they're playing the music and that. The next day... I'm in the commissary, and the show had aired the night before. And so who's in the commissary doing a Love Boat for Aaron Spelling, but Ginger Rogers.
Wow.
She sees me sitting in the commissary.
No.
She walks over to me. She says, Jamie, I saw this show last night. She says, you know, that dress looked a hell of a lot better on you than it did on me.
Oh, my God. That would have been a great. That's a moment. That is a great moment.
Ginger Rogers. Wow.
Yeah.
So, okay. You guys, and I've heard the story, and it's a great story. Did you want to ask something? I'm sorry.
Being a car fan.
I'm just so excited. I'm sorry.
No, because this is very, very close to your heart.
It really is.
I want to switch gears, and I want to talk about Cannibal.
Oh, Cannibal.
That was a party.
Because
those were parties. I mean, that wasn't a sober breath.
I almost forgot about Cannibal.
Yeah. A lot of people would like to forget Cannibal.
Oh, I loved it. Are you crazy? No, oh, my goodness.
Cannibal was... It's just a classic movie. But, you know, Cannibal has got such great actors. Some of the actors were, sadly, at the end of their careers. Some were in the middle of their careers. But if you look at people like Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., who were probably just clowns on the set.
Yes.
There was a young guy who's done unbelievable amounts of movies, Jackie Chan,
right.
Who's just gone... I mean, this is, you know... It's
that was Al Ruddy produced that with Harvest Productions. The producer did a lot of the Jackie Chan movies.
Yeah, Harvest Productions is Chinese-based.
Yeah, that's why Jackie Chan was in it.
It was 40 years.
I got to tell you, there wasn't a sober breath on there. It was a party type.
Wow.
Everybody. I mean, working with Dean and Sammy... And Roger Moore, Farrah Fawcett.
Well, I was going to say Adrian
Barbeau. Farrah Fawcett.
We did Shirley MacLaine. We did several of the Cannonball Run movies. It was really
Farrah Fawcett.
Yes.
I mean,
you know that terrible accident happened on there with the Aston Martin. They had the double for Farrah Fawcett and the double for Roger Moore.
Right.
And the whoever was signaling something. Gave a wrong cue, and the car crashed into and actually paralyzed the stunt
girl. No, it's so sad.
And almost killed the
Roger Moore.
The Roger Moore double.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a great great tragedy that
sobered a couple people up, maybe. But,
yeah. I mean, Burt Reynolds. You know, we sadly lost him just. You know,
I knew Burt
September,
very well. Yeah.
And I've got
Clint Eastwood and Burt. They were good buddies. Eastwood and I were in class together, acting classes. Clint was cleaning swimming pools at that time, and I was cleaning chinchilla dropping pans in Burbank.
You were not.
Yeah. We didn't have any money. We were in class. It was Jack Coslin's class. It was at the Mercury Theater on Cole Avenue. Bob Donner, who was Exeter on Mork and Mindy, was on that class. Nick Adams, Irish McCullough, who later was Sheena, the Jungle Queen. And we were all in the class. And so I always tease Clint all the time. I always say, what the heck ever happened to you? You know, did you do anything with swimming pools? You know,
done a few things.
Yeah, he's great. He's the nicest guy. I got to tell you, Clint is just the same kind of guy that
Burt Reynolds. I mean,
and Burt as well. Yeah,
he must have been with that big smile.
Yeah.
And Dom DeLuise, you know. Wow.
Dominic, yeah. Oh. Charles Nelson Reilly. Imagine Dom DeLuise and Charles Nelson Reilly.
He was a bit of a clown, wasn't he, Dom? Always into trouble.
Well, oddly enough, my agent, who represents me today, he represented Dom DeLuise and Charles Nelson Reilly.
Did you do Hollywood Squares with Charles Nelson Reilly? Or was it the Paul Lynde era?
I never did Hollywood Squares with them. Okay. I did Hollywood Squares later, but I didn't do Match Game that much. I did The Gong Show with
We're going to talk about that.
J.P. Morgan and that. I helped set that show with Chuck. The show, when it first went on, wasn't heading in the right direction, and Chuck came to me and asked me a few things. When you get to it enough...
I will get to it.
And then I did... Password, Super Password.
You did them all.
Tattletales.
Yep, you did them all.
Oh, gosh, I can't. There were so many of them.
And then heaps of national commercials.
Yeah, I did Wonder Bread. I did...
Kentucky... did you do...
I did Kentucky Fried... I did...
Did you do Kentucky Fried Chicken?
No.
Okay.
After Six Tuxedos...
You did a soda?
I did... sodas. I did like a post-it thing. They call them clingers.
Okay.
And
did they really?
Yeah, they call it clingers, but with a C, you know, instead of the K.
Oh, okay.
And one of the gags was they threw me up against the wall and I stuck.
Yeah. That's very funny. And you actually did one of the original IBM commercials with Loretta Swit.
Yeah. Did IBM?
IBM computers.
I can't remember.
And the computer was bigger than he was in the commercial.
How big are the computers?
Oh, yeah. Bigger than my head.
Yeah, well, that must be listen, pretty big, you know,
huge.
This is a little more than my 65th year in this business, so it's difficult for me.
No, believe me.
You won't be tested on this.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, let's segue back to MASH, and then we can go to whatever you want to go to.
I just love that show. I watch it every night.
Yeah, we do.
So do I.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. The one of the ones I directed was on the other night.
Which one did you direct?
It was called Friends and Enemies.
Yes. Okay.
And I directed that. That was very exciting for me. We each directed, you know, every once in a while to see if we could do it.
I like the fact that they let you actually act when you did Loretta or Major Julian's birthday.
That won her an Emmy. She says to me, Jamie, thank you, because she says, I won my Emmy
because of you.
Yeah,
your generosity.
Yeah.
What a great episode.
No, I mean, that's nice.
Well, you know what I mean.
Loretta is just absolutely terrific.
She's amazing.
Wonderful actress.
You guys were very close.
The entire cast was very close.
But you could see the closeness on, because it's that love-hate on, you know, when you have that love-hate on the screen, you can see that you really actually are very, very close.
Yeah. I have to tell you, we've lost a few of our writers.
Yeah.
We lost a few of our producers. We lost a lot of our crew members. And then, of course, a lot of our main characters. The last one, I think, was David Ogden Stiers.
Man.
That very touching. And then Bill Christopher. Bill never gets talked about much, but he was absolutely wonderful as Father Mulcahy.
Jocularity!
I don't think you could find...
Can you do the jocularity?
Jocularity.
I love it.
Yeah.
Jocularity!
Like, I loved him. He was always on Hogan's Heroes.
Yes, yeah.
Loved him on Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, he was wonderful. Bill had such
great
a quality,
too.
We all loved him, and he was such a pleasure. He brought, you know, all of those actors brought so many different facets. It wasn't just Johnny One Note, you know. They were all kinds of different things. You could give them anything to do. You could give Harry absolutely something silly and bizarre or whatever it was, and then something really very serious and very touching or something very dramatic or something. And you could give any of those actors on that show, and they could all do it. It was just absolutely wonderful working with them.
Were you worried about taking Radar's spot on the show?
Yes and no, but they figured, how do you replace Radar?
You don't.
He was such an indelible character, such a lovable character. So, you know, it's better to kind of give me a battlefield commission and
move
into that.
Absolutely.
That you were used to it.
Absolutely.
And let me fumble, you know, through it rather than try to bring in a character that's an absolute character that you're going to have to introduce. And that,
this way they
just kind of retooled me a little bit, you know, to do that. So,
it worked.
Yes, it worked. But there again is another scary moment because if it doesn't work, you know, that those are the things that shows get canceled.
Jeff and I we did a sales trailer recently, and I've done film and I've been directing documentaries, and I love film. I love film. I love waiting 9 hours to get called to set. I love everything about it. We're walking into a very dark room right now with television series. How hard is it really to do? Was it? It's 13 episodes in 9 weeks. I mean, what's the schedule like for a typical season of a half an hour show?
You talk about today?
Yeah.
Oh well, you know I'm doing the cool kids.
I know you're doing the cool kids. You are one of the cool kids.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. And it's different. First of all, it's not film; it's digital.
Right.
And film, you couldn't do as many takes as they do with digital because it costs money.
Yeah, way too much
money.
Yeah,
of the film.
Yep.
So, and then you have writers. We used to have a few writers on our show. Now there's like 14 of them. You know? And they all come down. And then you have the network run-throughs and the studio run-throughs during the time. So the script is never the script you start out with.
Never.
I could do a paper sale, you know, that huge paper from the rewrites of just one show that we've done.
Wow.
And so and they also change lines now, even when you're doing the show.
Right.
You know, they'll say, okay, now let's try this one. Let's try this. With the Cool Kids, what they started out doing it with an audience.
Yes.
Then they said, okay, let's not do it with an audience. It takes too much time and so forth. We'll just do it like the old fashioned, without an audience, and shoot it like a movie. We'll do it. We'll shoot Thursday and Friday and get all the pages done. So now, I went back to them. I've done maybe 8 shows with them, and now they're pre-shooting things like on Thursday, and then Friday night at 4 o'clock they do it with an audience.
Okay,
and then show the stuff that
the dailies,
the pre-shot stuff to the audience. And
okay,
then do it. And it takes a long time. I mean, it just and then you have to have the comedian in the audience, you know, to keep the audience happy and keep them interested in it, because you've got to do retakes.
And then the showrunners and
yeah,
because MASH was what, 4 days per episode?
MASH was 5 days. We were given no, and we never completed it in 5 days. We always would have a couple scenes that we'd have to bank. And then we'd start another show, and then we'd have some more, a couple scenes. We'd have a pickup day with maybe 4 or 5 different shows. That's why I said we go to the ranch sometimes,
right,
and we do 5 different shows, but, you know, different stories that they had and different costumes and everything else. And
right,
we'd have to
wow,
you know, same thing on. We'd try to do it like we stay in Radar's tent, let's say.
Okay.
You know, and or Radar's office.
Right, right.
And do it that way. But they were very good to us, CBS and Fox, in terms of allowing us the time, because they knew they had a quality show.
Oh yeah, you can't rush. Like you can't rush
it. No,
because it would show.
Yes, yeah,
it would show like Klinger slip.
The writing,
thank you,
was so good.
We didn't want that to happen.
No, I know.
I think you mentioned that the writing was so great.
Oh, it really was.
Yeah. Even today, when you look at, you know, other shows that are very successful, you're not going to get any writing
no,
like that.
But it wasn't never consistently funny. It was never consistently serious.
They gave us a new name. We called us a dramedy.
And you never knew what you were going to watch. But you know what? That's shooting dice in Vegas, because you don't know. Like, come on, I'm trying to watch a funny show. Now I'm sucked into this, watching this clock with this kid having to
right,
get, you
yeah,
know. And you sat there and watched that clock, man.
Yeah.
I did. I watched that clock. Like, I hope he gets a transplant.
And there's a lot of memorable lines in that show, and I always bring that one. You hear the bullet or something was called.
Yes, you never hear the bullet.
You never hear the bullet.
Right.
And it's Alan and McLean sitting outside of the operating room on a bench. They're both tired. They've been operating in the room, and Alan is so disgusted because his dear friend was in there.
Right, and he actually heard the bullet this
yeah,
time. Yeah,
yeah. Yep. And so, but the line, he says, Hawkeye, I know, he says, but he says, war. He said, there are rules in war. He says, rule number one is that people die in wars, and rule number two is doctors can't change rule number one.
Yeah.
What a great line.
Powerful.
You know? Yeah.
Now, you know, MASH was such a successful show. Was there any discussion about maybe doing something after that?
Well, like, we did. We tried after MASH, but
yeah,
it didn't work for several reasons. I wanted to make it like the best years of our lives.
Right. Could you move a little closer to the mic if you don't mind? I'm sorry.
Sure, of course.
Perfect.
Yeah, I wanted to make it like the best years of our lives. Great, great movie.
One of my best favorite movies.
Exactly,
yeah.
one of my favorite, where the GIs come back, you
yep,
know,
yep,
and they're not necessarily accepted and so forth. But there was just discrepancies. They said, well, this is 1980, best years of our lives won't work. I always say good is good. You know, good is good at any time.
Right. No, I know.
And so they didn't do it. And then what they kind of went, the emphasis kind of went on the characters that didn't bring them to the series. You know, they were secondary characters, and they didn't have the depth that the characters that we had on
right,
MASH.
Right.
Rather than staying with Bill and Harry and me, who brought you to the series cell,
yep,
they decided to go with these characters that they were trying to bring in, and it just never worked. And we were up against, I think, the A-team, and we got clobbered.
So yeah, a little bit.
We got canceled after the second year.
Did you watch Trapper John M.D.?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
with Benell Roberts?
Good friend. Yeah. Purnell, and I became good friends with Gregory Harrison.
What'd you think of that?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It was okay.
I think it would have been better if they would have brought in OGs, you know what I mean? Original guys.
Yeah. Well, they. I don't know whether Wayne wanted to do that or not. Wayne was, you know, never signed a contract.
Well, Wayne did another doctor show.
Yeah, House Calls.
House Calls, yeah, right, right.
But he never signed his contract.
Really?
At Fox. And he didn't like what was happening because it was supposed to be pretty much, well, when I say he didn't like it,
right.
the proposition was that he and Alan would be equals, you know, on the show.
Right.
And they started to go heavily toward Alan more so. And Wayne was saying, well, you know, I don't want to be just an echo to the person. I want to have my own personality.
Absolutely.
And so they had a misunderstanding, and he left the show. And Fox was going to sue him, but he had never signed the contract.
Wow.
Then he went over. He did House Calls, very successful show, which he owned a piece of.
Very funny.
Great show.
And then he went over and did City of Angels, which was another show. It's a detective thing, an hour-long show. So Wayne was a very smart businessman. You know, he was also a business manager.
Real estate. He also did real estate, right?
Well, he also was a business manager. He was business manager for Peter Falk.
Oh, really?
And his mother's brother.
Wow.
Yeah, Peter Falk and he were roommates in New York.
I did not know that. Yeah. Did you know that?
I'm sure there's a few stories they could tell us.
Oh, boy. At least be a fly on that wall, huh? What I make a habit of doing is I watch every interview that you guys do before I sit down. And I never want to ask you the same thing that you've been asked a million and one times. And it's hard with such a long career. One of the dead ends I kept running into, because everybody thinks the last episode was the last episode, and it wasn't. You came back and did the final episode, and Alan Alda has mentioned it that you guys.
The time capsule.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you guys actually buried a real time capsule.
Yeah, it was my idea.
Okay.
I said, why don't we. Bury a time capsule on the 20th Century Fox lot. We're doing the show. We'll take some of the things that we use, the props and memorabilia stuff, and then 10, 15, 20 years
later, you'll leave a note.
And we'll tell everybody that where it's buried and that. What a great little publicity thing.
Right.
So what we did is we got a friend of ours. He was Jay King is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out and we tried to find an area where we thought they would not do construction on it. It was right by the commissary area.
Okay.
So Jay dug this big hole, and then we all waited until midnight when the studio, nobody was at the studio.
Nice.
And Arlene Alda, Alan's wife, came over with her camera. She's a wonderful photographer.
Okay.
And we all had champagne and that, and we made a dedication of the things that we put in a sealed tight, waterproof, Red Cross casing.
Right.
And we made this.
How brilliant is that by itself?
And then we put it into the thing. We all toasted it, and then we each put dirt on top of it.
Wow.
Okay. And we thought, wow, this is going to be a great story eventually, you know, for somebody, especially if you reshow the episode of the time capsule. Well, it turns out that they decided to do some construction.
A lot.
And they did it right by the commissary.
Oh.
And they dug up the area, and they found this box.
Right.
And they called Alan Alda. And they said, hey, we found this box here. Is it an important thing? And the guy didn't know what it was or whatever it is. And Alan didn't want to, you know, tell him that.
Right.
So the guy threw it away. He just put it in the thing.
Okay.
It had his purple robe.
That's what I'm asking. Yeah, okay. Yeah. This is the big secret, because I've heard five people tell the story. Who put what in the box? That's what I want to know.
Okay, I'm trying to remember.
That purple robe's amazing.
Yeah, the purple robe, I think. Gary wasn't with us at that time,
I know.
The teddy bear didn't go in.
His teddy bear's in the Smithsonian.
The other teddy bear, but I think they did put a teddy bear.
Did they? Okay.
In that box, and I think I put a hat and a dress and some high heels in there. And,
just in case.
Yeah, Loretta, I'm trying to remember what Loretta put in, but David Ogden Stiers.
Probably put a few records.
Put his phonograph in?
Yeah. No, it's hard for me to remember.
Okay.
It's been so many years.
But every interview, nobody ever says what went in that box. It's the first time I've heard it.
Yeah.
That's great. My last question for you is, and I know you've got a bunch more. The last episode, okay, take me through the emotions, and most of all, for me personally, as an actor, the decompression, because I've been having a hard time with decompression.
That last week was probably one of the most horrendous weeks we ever had, besides trying to shoot the show.
Yeah.
And the content of the show.
Yes.
We had press things. I mean, we were on the morning CBS morning show. We were all, PBS was after us. Every magazine, People Magazine, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, Life Magazine. Right. Everybody was after us.
Yep.
And then on top of that, the last. Well, that week, I'm sorry, I'm mixing this up now a little bit. It was horrendous. We just didn't have a private moment at all.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I said I mixed this up, because as you pointed out, the last show that was shown was not the last show that we did. The last show we did was the Time Capsule.
Correct.
And that was a horrible week, too, because the last day of shooting, we had 400 press people on the set on stage 9.
Wow.
During that scene where we're all putting the stuff into the day. And then when Bert Metcalf directed it, he was our associate producer and producer later, and casting director. He helped, you know, bring all these wonderful people together.
Sure.
And he said, that's a print, that's cut, print it, and that's a wrap.
Wow.
And you would not believe, we have some footage of somebody taking a picture of all the people that were on stage 9. You couldn't move. It was like a subway. You know?
Oh, was it?
Yeah. It was.
How lackluster.
Oh, wow. It was. And of course, people were crying. And then, as I said, they were taking anything they could off the
walls. I could cry right now.
Memorabilia. Things that you wouldn't believe. I tried to protect some of the stuff. I do. I still have the fuzzy pink slippers that I flew over the compound with. I have. I think I have my combat boots that I had.
Do you have the Dorothy outfit?
Yes, I have the Mary Janes from the Wizard of Oz thing that I did with Toto.
Oh, I loved
the
it.
Dog. Yeah,
the little Korean dog.
I have a curio. I mean, you were at the house, but it's on the second floor. Curio cabinet, and I have some of the stuff in there that I saved, but there was hardly anything, you know, left.
Scavengers went crazy.
Oh, yeah, anything they would take. You know, another thing, that stage 9 was one of the oldest stages, and it took them years before they built a bathroom on that stage for us. We used to have to cross the street to go to a bathroom that was just a general bathroom for people.
Unbelievable.
That's how cheap they were and how old that soundstage was. And they eventually put a bathroom so that we didn't have to go. You know, if it was raining or something and you had your wardrobe and any of the women with hairdos or anything.
Listen,
like
it rains in Korea. Go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, MASH finished in 1983, so you're talking about, you know, close to 40 years ago.
Correct, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I told you how old I was.
I know, and I was like, and I'm doing math, and I'm like, wait a minute, that makes me 51. I'm like, I'm 51 years old. Oh, my God.
Jamie was, you're a July birthday?
Mm-hmm.
So Jamie's about to turn 50, right?
Right.
Just, you know, in a few months.
Yep.
There was no email. There was no...
That's exactly right.
There was fax.
There was no cell phones. There was no nothing.
There was no cell phones. Right. There was answer machines.
There were phones that, you remember, in the car. You had this big battery that sat in the trunk.
And it was like $6 a minute to answer it.
Yeah,
Or the brick.
Yeah.
The big brick.
The brick.
But did you get a lot of fan mail?
Oh, tremendous. I still get fan mail. You should see the fan mail that I receive. And they're wonderful letters. They're not just, I mean, you get this. Can I have a picture? I'm a big fan, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not making fun of them, but that's the usual kind of
thing
that you get. We get these lengthy, lengthy letters. How meaningful the show was.
I wrote you this novel.
These people have, and what it meant to them. I can't tell you how many people said they went into medicine because of that show, where they became doctors and nurses and that. And I always tell Alan, I said, you notice, Alan, no one ever said they became an actor. Only doctors and nurses.
I did.
No, watching the show.
I know. I did.
We didn't inspire anybody. So,
all I knew is it made my father really happy.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, the heartwarming letters that we get, and parents that the kids that watch it with their parents when it was on originally, they're now parents and they watch it with their kids and the show. I can't tell you how many people when I go on that studio lot at Fox that there's still some of the people that are there, some of the guards that are at the studio will come over to me and tell me, could I talk to you? Because I was a little boy, and I watched the show with my parents, you know. I mean, I'm like an icon.
But you are an icon. Yeah. Is, you mean like an icon.
The thing is, you have not changed a bit.
Have you always been approachable?
In most
situations?
Well, I am from Toledo.
What do you want from the guy?
Oh, you know what? So funny, we were talking about Toledo the other day. I'm sorry, am I cutting you off?
No, never.
Okay, Adam's Ribs.
Oh, yeah. Well,
tell me about, please.
No, Adam's Ribs was in Chicago, and that really existed, but it's not there anymore. But Tony Paco's is still there.
Tony Paco's Hot Dogs.
The Hot Dogs in Toledo. You know, I had a golf tournament there with the LPGA for 30 years. I raised over $8.5 million.
God bless you.
Children's Charities and Abused Women of Northwest Ohio.
That's beautiful.
And they named a park. I have a park named after me. It's a park at Riverside Park I used to go to as a kid.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Danny Thomas's nephew, Ronnie Jacobs, was at Waite High School, the east side, and I was at Woodward High School on the north side where Danny Thomas had gone.
Right, right.
And the night before we both went to California, we both sat on the swings at that park.
Wow.
That's now my park. I have pictures here on my
iPhone. I'd love to see them.
The park. And they have a softball diamond, a shelter house, a swimming pool. They have swings and slides there. It's great. Well, I was just back there. You know, I at Christmas time this 2018.
Yes.
I went to Cleveland with the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. You know, the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra is probably one of the greatest orchestras, not only in the United States but in the world.
Okay.
Okay. This is at Severance Hall, and Richard Kaufman, who's a dear friend of mine, Richard will take over for John Williams in the Boston Pops.
John Williams is huge, and Boston Pops is huge.
Well, Richard Kaufman takes over for him.
Wow.
That's who John Williams asked.
Does he get the Star Wars job?
And sometimes.
Yeah.
And then he also does a lot of things for motion pictures, conducts the orchestra.
Right, right, right. That's what I'm saying, for Star
Richard,
Wars. Yeah, yeah.
Richard does, anyway, he was the visiting conductor, and he asked me to do, 'twas the night before Christmas, to Randy Bass's music that they wrote especially for it with the Cleveland Symphony.
Please tell me there's somebody filmed this.
I have some pictures also of that. And if you were to walk down the halls in Severance Hall, these are actual pictures. It would be like if you went to the Baseball Hall of Fame and you saw Babe Ruth's signature.
Yeah, man.
And Lou Gehrig and all these wonderful baseball players. Leopold Stokowski. Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo Ma.
Yehudi Menuhin. Itzhak Perlman. You walked out. And I got to tell you, and I say this with great humility, for me to walk this kid from the north end of Toledo, walk on that stage with this great orchestra and this huge choir. It's almost like the Mormon Tabernacle.
Sure. They're huge.
And get a standing ovation.
Isn't that beautiful?
At the end of 'Twas the Night Before
Christmas.
Wow.
That's I hope there's film of that somewhere.
Yeah, Richard has it. Richard Kaufman.
Oh, does he? That's beautiful. Yeah, I was born in Paterson, New Jersey. I went and saw the Louis Costello statue, and all I got was mugged.
Yeah.
All I got was mugged. You know?
I love that. You know, Dean Martin had my nose. Dino Crocetti had my nose.
Did he really?
You know who gave him the money to get it fixed? Lou Costello.
Did he really?
Yeah, Lou gave him the money, and I became dear friends with.
I did not know that.
With he passed Craig. Craig Martin. I played golf at Calabasas Country Club, and Craig had the locker next to me.
Wow.
Craig Martin married Lou Costello's daughter.
Believable.
And they got so that was Dean Martin.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. But then I think her name was Gloria. It was Gloria Costello. She passed away from cancer.
Oh, that's sad.
And then shortly after that, Craig passed away from cancer.
Yeah, I remember where I was when like Groucho Marx died and Zeppo died, and you know, just I'm so glad you're still here. I really am.
I was at the the Algonquin Hotel and had martinis with Anita Gillette. And,
did you really?
Yeah, and Jerry Orbach's widow.
Wow.
We were there and we sat at the famous table where
that's very
you know
funny.
Groucho and
yep.
and Margaret
Robert
Dumont. Yeah. Not Margaret Dumont. That was Dorothy Parker.
Dorothy Parker.
Yeah. Dorothy Parker said that about Katharine Hepburn in a movie, she had to range from A to B.
Well, we got to try to get Harpo's son on the radio.
Yeah. I was doing an autograph show because I had done some acting earlier in my life. And I was in Anaheim at the Wizard World convention, and I stood in front of Loretta Swit. I interview people for a living for Rolling Stone, and I stood there and went, like, I couldn't even talk to her. I felt so embarrassed. Yeah. My entire career, I always wanted to talk to somebody. I wanted to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. You know, I got to tell you, it's amazing because I didn't think I was that important.
I talked to Jimmy Carter, you know, because I was part of the Lustgarten Foundation raising money for pancreatic cancer research. I got to talk to Jimmy Carter. I'm like, and we talk about pancreatic cancer research. But this means something to me personally.
You know, I've been to the White House several times. One of them was when
I've been thrown
President,
out
President Carter was, and Rosalind were there. It was when they didn't go to the Olympics.
Okay.
And I performed at Kennedy Center.
Unbelievable.
And then we were all given a special, I have it at the house there.
Yes.
A special belt buckle, silver, that
wow.
we gave only to the Olympiads
yep.
and the people that performed at Kennedy Center that night.
Wow.
And then I've been to the White House with President Ford. President Reagan and
my
President
favorite.
George Herman Walker Bush. Yes, I was there each time.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I don't have the picture. I went there. We gave him MASH running jackets to, at that time, President Bush.
Don't even start talking about jackets. He's got every production jacket you've ever seen in my life. He's, yeah. wow.
We gave one to the vice president. It was Bush, and then we gave Mr. Reagan his
I love Ronald. Ronald Reagan's the first president I ever got to vote for. I was glad I did.
You know, it became a good friend of mine, and I loved very much, was William Holden. And
really?
William Holden was Ronald Reagan's best man.
Isn't that funny?
At their wedding.
Wow.
If you go to Reagan Ranch, you'll see them sitting at the... At Chasen's restaurant, that booth that they have there, that's where they went.
I was actually working with Christie's Auction House at the time, because we all have to work while we're trying to act. And I got put to task because they did a replica of his office.
Yeah.
And I had to put all the sculptures. I had to find replicas of all the sculptures from the original artist, limited edition, like the one with the cowboy on the horse standing. I found every one of the sculptures.
Wow.
Yeah, what a year that was. But I helped build the Ronald Reagan Museum.
That's one of the greatest museums.
It really
I tell
is.
Everybody, you have to go there.
It's identical. I mean,
yes.
statue, sculpture for sculpture. All the patina's correct. Everything, I mean, had to be correct. You would have been proud being the collector. I hustled
No, I've been to the museum. It's beautiful. It's what, 25 minutes from here.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's a great museum. And to walk through Air Force One like that. And,
isn't that fun?
Yeah, to take the pictures. It really is an experience. And we bought some jelly beans.
You know what's so funny? He used to get them from Sugarloaf, New York.
Honestly?
Yeah, Sugarloaf, New York, right next to Warwick, New York. That's where he imported his jelly beans from. Sugarloaf, New York was the jelly bean capital of I guess the United States at that time.
I
get mine from CVS.
Yeah, nice. I get mine from your rabbit in the back. I don't know what they are.
Definitely not jelly beans. They're not jelly beans, mate.
No. Jelly bellies or something.
Yes.
Yeah,
but he was getting like the exotic flavors, and they have like a big thing about him in New York about him buying his jelly beans. You know, we had Carter with the peanuts, and we had. Him with the jelly beans. It was a good time back then, you know?
And President Bush with broccoli.
Yeah. And his vice president with the tomatoes or tomatoes or whatever it is. It's always something with those people.
Yeah.
Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to ask Jamie, you know, filming down at the Malibu State Park, obviously, I wanted to find out if there's any challenges there because obviously you're working down there with, you know, a lot of wildlife. A lot of rattlesnakes, a lot of deer.
No, we didn't. We didn't
no
have any. No, there weren't any challenges at all. That was the Fox Ranch,
right?
And they used to have a big cyclorama there and an area where they could put water in, and you could do miniature scenes of battleships battles and things like that.
Wow!
Yeah, and Planet of the Apes was shot there.
Yep.
Jesse James with Tyrone Power and Henry Fonda, I think, was shot there. Can you imagine going out to that ranch in the 30s? I mean, how remote that must have been.
Jeez.
Well, there was
to go out there.
Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan did a lot of shooting down there.
I didn't know that.
There was actually, it was quite funny. I was watching a movie, and right at the end of the movie, I saw the 101 freeway in the background.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's beautiful. I mean, it's...
Well, that was supposed to be like in Snows of Kilimanjaro because the back lot at Fox which is now Century City.
Yes.
But at that time, Gregory Peck and is it Susan Hayward, or I forgot who it was. Anyway, they said they could see something with the freeway in the background.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
Yeah. We lost the Paramount Ranch, too, I think.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
In the fires.
I never told you about the Chuck Barris thing with the...
Can we segue back to that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we need to go back.
Oh, my yes. God.
I only want to tell you this.
This is a conversation we have to have.
The first guest, John,
yes.
was... first of all, they had sold it in syndication with Gary Owens, okay?
Yes, I remember and that. With the deep voice.
Yeah, but then they did it for NBC.
Right.
And John Barber was the host of the Gong Show.
Right.
And the first guest they had was Jack Cassidy, Joanne Worley, and me. And the Milton DeLug and the band, they had these carny outfits on, straw hats
sure.
and red stripe things. And C.B. Allberg was the gal there, but she was kind of dressed, in a different way. And John Barber was the whole, and the show wasn't going anywhere because, first of all, we're performers. We're not producers. And they're bringing on people that crack eggs on their heads.
Yeah.
And you can't say, well, do this. And standards and practices is you have to watch what you say and do
all
this.
Of course.
So Chuck comes in. We were all in just regular clothes. And so Chuck says, Jamie, what's wrong? I said, well, I always learned a long time ago, if you got garbage, wrap it up in a nice package.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
So why don't we window dress it? Put us in tuxedos, the ladies in evening gowns, the band in tuxedos like that, and go the opposite way. Don't
sure.
make it look like it's a sideshow at a carnival.
Right.
Make it look like it's an elegant thing. Now you got a guy come out, hangs from his feet, and cracks eggs on his head or plays a harmonica.
Yep.
He says, that's great. So John Barber never got it.
Wow.
He's still looking for Mario Lanza,
looking
for Barbra Streisand or something on the show. So that's when Chuck finally took over. And then that became
brilliant.
A house party.
Chuck Barris.
Yeah.
I mean, brilliant.
J.P. Morgan and me. And
Paul Williams.
Artie Johnson. We were the...
The unknown comic.
Yeah. Langsford. Yeah.
Yes.
I forgot his name. Murray Langsford.
And the... was it Mean Gene the Dancing Machine?
Oh, yeah. Do you know, he was just a
the
stage
janitor.
Hand.
He was a janitor. Or
a stage
like sleep. Yeah.
Do you know...
He lost his legs.
On, yeah. He got sugar diabetes.
Diabetes and lost both of his legs.
Yeah.
A little shame.
But Chuck and him became good buddies. And then we had Jerry, who was in the Wizard of Oz, was one of the munchkins on that. He was... They used to come out with...
And Carol Connors, who was in Deep Throat, was the blonde girl that... would always introduce Chuck Barris in the beginning.
Well, he had his daughter do intros and then had somebody else.
Who was the real blonde intro. Sexy one? That was Carol Connors.
No,
Carol...
that was C.B. Aubrey was the beautiful blonde model. She was on Hogan's Heroes.
Maybe
as a matter of
somebody
fact.
Else.
You must because I was trying to think of... we did one show where we didn't even tell Chuck what we were going to do. John Dorsey was the director of the thing.
Here we go. I want to hear this.
Yeah. What happened was we said, hey, it was J.P., Artie, and I. We said, why don't we take over the show? We get tired of Chuck clapping his hands and telling those terrible jokes and that. So we said to the prop people, I said, can you get us some duct tape in that? And we didn't tell the producing people or anything what we were going to do because they just ran with anything that you did. It was tape.
So
if they didn't like it, they could change it. So what we did is we decided we had enough of Chuck. We grabbed him while he was trying to do the, and we got some rope and we tied him up and put duct tape on him and moved him to the back of the stage where he couldn't get it. And then JP and Artie and I took over the show. We held up the cue cards and each one of us would do intros to the act. And John Dorsey was very smart. He cut back to Chuck trying to get out of the ropes and the tape and that.
Wow.
We did the whole show and that was just impromptu. I mean, it was the whole thing. It was absolutely funny. Chuck just loved that.
I remember one of the biggest publicity stunts. And a lot of people may not remember this, and I don't have my computer. My computers are doing audio stuff right now. When J.P. Morgan flashed.
If you remember correctly, I used to do was remember we'd fight at the gong?
Yes.
And I'd do it. A lot of those times I was fighting when I got her on the ground to stop her from exposing her bosoms.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Because I know she got away with it that one time, and the press went berserk.
I wasn't there.
Oh, is that what it was?
I wasn't there.
Okay.
And she actually did it.
Yep.
And the standards and practices, everybody came down. They warned Chuck and them
that
they were
going
to take them off the air if they did it. But I,
do you remember
I
that?
I say, I remember that. She said,
I was a little kid watching
she said,
it.
It's a tape show. I said, it doesn't matter. There are kids out there.
No, we saw it. I mean, they aired it.
But I'm saying that she didn't think it was okay because it was a tape show. I said, you can't do that, Jay. I said, there's people out there.
Wow.
Well, how about the Popsicle Twins? You remember that one?
No.
Oh, you know, well, I won't tell you about it.
So okay. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
Oh, yeah. I was in it. George Clooney directed it, and he used clips from JP.
I loved it. How crazy was it?
Oh, it was insane.
I mean, I'm just going to ask you, was he in the CIA?
I don't think so.
I don't think so, really.
I don't.
But you never know, though.
No, you don't know.
I know he moved to France and everything afterwards, he died with the girl of his dreams. And
yeah, he also had a place in New York. He asked JP and me to come. He had a penthouse place, and he was doing some things for CNN after he had left the show and everything, and sold, I think, everything to Sony, and asked JP and I to come in, and we did something with him in New York and went to his penthouse, and we had dinner and that. But he was a very unique individual. Very
unbelievable.
Very yeah.
Because I hang out with Corey Eubanks, the son of Bob Eubanks.
Yeah, Bob and I are very close.
Yeah, so you know Corey then.
Bob and Larry Donizetti. Larry passed away.
Yep.
They published my book with me.
I loved your book.
Just for fun, yeah.
Yeah,
if you see it, you'll see Bob and Larry's name on it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Tell me about how we can see you on The Cool Kids.
Well, it's Friday nights at 8:30. I'm not on every one of them. I don't know. You know, I don't know how they're going to, even though you do them in sequential order, they may move them around and decide that they want to, you know, show one ahead of the other one. So I couldn't possibly tell you, you know, when I'm going to be on.
But you're proud of the work, though.
Oh, yeah. The last one I did was last week, and it's the story of how Leslie Jordan became one of the cool kids. It was Hank, David Alan Grier, and Martin Mull were the originals, and then they were going to bring in Leslie Jordan. But it turns out that the character I played, Dudley, was they asked me first, and I turned them down. And Leslie Jordan is very upset to think that this character,
right.
And so we do a reenactment of it. And they dressed Vicki Lawrence up as Leslie Jordan.
Love her.
They put the wig on her, and they did all kinds of stuff. And she talks to you like Leslie does in the show. And then the payoff of it is that I show up dressed as Margaret, which is Vicki Lawrence's character.
That's great.
With the jewelry on
and a
wig on and everything else. And yeah, it was pretty funny. So
this is great.
Anything else?
I'm just overwhelmed.
I'm so overwhelmed.
It's been fantastic.
Is there anybody you want to give a shout out to or say thank you to? Or
well, obviously I got a lot of people in my lifetime, and most of them aren't around today in my lifetime. But I've been so lucky in this business. I work with some of the most marvelous people, and some of the kindest people, and it's been a great career. Look at I'm going to be 85.
And you're still working.
And I'm still working.
Unbelievable.
And the phone's still ringing, you know. And the thing that I was in Cleveland, you know, doing with the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra.
Who knew, right? Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, great.
I got to thank you. I know my father is smiling again.
Oh, good.
And this is great. I'm Eric Danger Nienhuis.
I'm Jeff the Collector Aberdeen.
And I'm Jamie Farr.
You certainly are. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks,
my pleasure.
Jamie.
Okay.
And we'll be back.